question, or is it always, I was told? At what point do you have control over the TV dial and your radio dial and what you read and what you think? Or is it always, I was told, and I don't want to be disfellowshipped by my group?
Well, here's a question I was just asking someone earlier. Do you think the American people are capable of self-rule at this point in time? Are they too mesmerized by the TV tube and basically the corporate media and so forth to make any rational decisions? Are they just too sheepalized?
In my opinion, we have the basis for a highest common denominator of society, but we reject it out of fear of being accountable as individuals. So we revert back to I was told, because we're afraid of being disfellowshipped, we're afraid of dealing with ambiguity, we're afraid of being wrong. So we want short, snappy answers, and we want enemies, and so we become these insane, polarized camps of sloganizing idiots, basically.
Thanks a lot. I certainly have to agree with quite a bit of what you said there in that last line. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
Well, I was going to talk about the borders and so forth, but I see that we're getting close to the end of our time here. We have 5 minutes. I'm particularly interested if you have any thoughts about the current healthcare system. I really think we're being backed into a corner. They're actually trying to make it so that there's absolutely no other system that's going to work except to have universal healthcare plan delivered by the government with all the attendant problems therein. But it's being arranged, just like Bob was saying. You know, if it costs hundreds of dollars for a blood test, last year I got a tick in my back where I couldn't reach it, so I went down to a healthcare doctor there and wanted to take it out, and they wanted $90 for less than a 3 minute procedure. And, that kind of system is absolutely insane. They're making the system so expensive and so crazy and so slanted that, that they're forcing us into this system. And as I say, if I had my druthers about it, I'd like to have an honest monetary system and government 100% out of health care. That even includes licensing, which would probably, scare most people. But you go back into the way the professions used to be, the guilds in Europe, each profession kind of regulated itself. There could be many other solutions than what we have. Well, the call-in number is 464-8295, and you'd have to call pretty fast in order to get in. So what I'd like to talk about in the last few remaining minutes here, there's a lot of laws that are coming down right now. The Homeland Security Act, it's draconian in what it's going to be doing to the Bill of Rights and our freedoms and liberties and so forth. I think one of the things that we still have in this country is trial by jury. And as jurors, you have the right always, as sitting there as a juror, to judge the law as well as the person, whether the person is guilty or not guilty. There's more. The judge will tell you that you can only judge whether the person is guilty or not guilty. You cannot judge whether it's a good law or bad law, which is an outright lie. As a juror, you can always judge the law itself. And that's what they mean by the fully informed jury, the knowledge that you as a juror can judge the law. I'd highly recommend people go on the internet to fija.org, fija.org, fija.org. That's the Fully Informed Jury Association. And they will tell you what you can do as a juror. And I see it as one of the last remaining safeguards that we have here. And I think it's going to behoove more and more of us to understand this and start promoting this among each other, because it's our capacity to deal with what's coming down is becoming severely limited. Thank you.
It was just about right on the second.
Yes, I find the range of that. Use what I can here.
Nice.
All right. to get this out.
Sounds like a good program. What was Bob talking about?
Well, I just talked about the healthcare system, and I was really asking people what they were talking about, and he had quite a bit to say about it.
What was his position?
Oh, well, he was pretty good at sort of dancing around what was actually needed. And he talked quite a bit about it.
It's sort of hard to hear what he's saying.
Basically, he thought the government should step in.
Well, I guess he's a hardline socialist. Isn't
yeah.
he? And if you think things are bad now, you just...
Yeah.
Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. David Wade. He's written a book, Infamy Revisited, Another Look at Pearl Harbor. And I really thought, well, you know, what else is there to say about Pearl Harbor? Certainly Robert Stinnett, I've interviewed him, and I've interviewed John Tolan, who wrote Infamy, and we've even put together a four-tape set on Pearl Harbor. But of course, I'm always interested in what else there might be out there, and I will tell you that David Wade has done a great job in this little book. It's only 111 pages, but it's a summary of everything that's been written. The writings of Charles Tansel, Background to War, or Backdoor to War, I guess it was, and certainly of what John Toland had written and Robert Stinnett had written. But then a lot of the details that led up to the war, he has done a beautiful job. It's fascinating reading, and I really think it's so important that we understand what happened at Pearl Harbor. And it will help us better to understand what happened September 11th last year. The government knew the Japanese were going to attack. The government knew when the Japanese were going to attack. The government tracked the Japanese fleet all across the Pacific and specifically withheld the information from the men at Pearl Harbor, and they were left there to die. And as terrible as that sounds, that is the truth, and we're going to talk a lot more about that. But let's fast forward now to September 11th last year. The government insists, Condoleezza Rice says, I mean, who would ever have thought that they would, hijack planes and crash them into our buildings? And yet, of course, if you've read the testimony by Kristen Breitweiser before the Senate Select Committee on the 18th of September of this last year, testimony which was intentionally censored from the media. We have this. We've actually, you can get it out on the internet under the Senate Intelligence Committee, but that's actually our October newsletter this year. We duplicated her entire testimony because I think every American needs to read it. And there was instance after instance after instance, several government studies talking about hijacking American airliners and crashing them into our buildings. And not only that, but they knew which buildings were going to be crashed into because they specifically named the World Trade Center something called Operation Bojinka. And that is covered up. I know it was covered up because right after September 11th, I got hold of some of the writings of Bill Gertz, who writes for the Washington Times. And in July of last year, 2 full months before the attack, he had written about Project Bajinka and the plan to crash planes into our World Trade Center. And yet, when he recently wrote a book about that, he specifically deleted any mention of it. And when I asked him on the radio why he had written this great scoop ahead of time, he wouldn't answer the question. Oh, well, that was the Philippine story. Well, it was the Philippine story. He knew that. That's what he said in his article. Obviously, they can't let the American people know that they knew the attack was coming. But then, of course, as Christine pointed out, within 2 hours of the attack, that we had no idea was coming and who was involved. Why FBI agents were at the schools, the flight schools where the people had taken their training. They were at the restaurants where they ate, the neighborhoods where they lived. How could that be within just a couple of hours if they had no idea what was going to happen? But, of course, we can't let the American people know that because, after all, the attack on the World Trade Center was used to justify going to war with Afghanistan because we had evidence that Osama bin Laden was behind it. But the trouble was we've never let anybody see the evidence. We have it, though, but we don't want Osama bin Laden to know that we have evidence that he was behind it, and they withheld that evidence from the American people. What evidence did they have? Well, they found a tape 6 months later where Osama bin Laden was talking about the attack, and we don't know whether that really was Osama bin Laden, and we don't know what was said, but they told us what was said because they flashed it on the screen. Although people who speak Arabic have heard the tape and they can't figure out what was being said, but that doesn't really matter. The perception was created in the minds of the American people by the controlled media and the television that this is what happened, and that unfortunately a lot of people believe it. And then, of course, we're going to war with Iraq. Why are we going to war with Iraq? Well, we're going to war with Iraq, after all. Saddam Hussein may attack New York City with one of these nuclear bombs he may have. We has chemical and biological weapons. We've known that because we gave it to him. Anybody who doubts that needs to get the book by Seymour Hersh, Against All Enemies. That's Against All Enemies, inexpensive little book. But it certainly goes into the background that, during the 1980s, we gave Saddam Hussein the chemical and biological weapons. We're so concerned that he has today that we've got to send our boys over to get killed and kill all the Iraqis to get those weapons back that we gave Saddam Hussein. What's wrong with this picture? Well, of course, what's wrong with it is because there's another agenda behind what's going on, but you could better understand the present by understanding the history. And that's why I think that David Wade's book, Infamy, Revisited, is so important. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure being here.
And, of course, you work with our good friend, Jerry McLaughlin?
Jerry McLaughlin.
All right, fine. Well, you're part of the family then, because I'm sure you've helped to schedule programs for us in the past. First of all, of course, you've been interested in military history for a long time. Why don't you tell ourselves a little bit about yourself? You graduated summa cum laude from the DePaul University in Chicago in 1973, and you were served as the Adjutant General for the Grand Army of the Republic Military Museum in Illinois, and you've been fascinated by these stories in history, military history, for a long time, haven't you?
Yes, I have, and in attempting to analyze myself and reach some conclusion as to just why, I suppose it has a lot to do with the fact that I grew up in the post-World War II generation, and my father and all of his brothers and most of the people he knew had served in the armed forces of the United States during the Second World War, when there were 1.5 million Americans under arms. And the events of the Second World War, when I was growing up, were as real as anything could be to me. And one of the things that was always talked about was Pearl Harbor. And I think that was really the door that opened to my interest on history in general, and military history in particular, and it's something that I've sustained throughout the years.
All right, fine. Well, let's get a little in the background, because, of course, what you do is you show very, very clearly that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president at the time, was simply not telling the truth. He kept talking about how he didn't want to get into war. We were going to maintain neutrality. And then he did just the opposite. But then, of course, you pointed out how he lied when, of course, he came into political office in 1932, how he ran as a conservative, and then promising to have a balanced budget and to get back to solid money and do away with all this big government. And then he did everything he criticized Herbert Hoover for doing.
What I tried to do is place the events that led up to Pearl Harbor within a certain context. And I think you have to understand Franklin D. Roosevelt, a man who, a matter of fact, there's a great quotation from General MacArthur when he was informed that Roosevelt died. He said, "Well, I hear the old man is dead. He never told the truth what a lie would do." And Roosevelt seems to be one of those people who is just naturally inclined towards duplicity. He enjoyed keeping secrets. He was in love with conspiracies. He was the sort of person who always liked to conceal his motives. And to him, it was a source of infinite amusement. If you read about this man's entire life, you find that this is a consistent thread of his personality. And it seems to me that that would make all the more probable the explanation of the events leading up to Pearl Harbor, which I attempt to justify.
Well, of course, you do a good job of just talking about the Depression, talking about certainly the tragedy that befell our nation, and then how, of course, Roosevelt, when he got in, first thing he did was declare a blank holiday and take the gold away from the American people. And then, of course, really put us onto a monetary system totally under the control of the little clique of private central bankers who control the Federal Reserve System. And, of course, the Depression didn't end. The Depression continued, and you reminded me that the Depression was starting to get better about 1938, and that all of his programs made it worse, and so we had a second dip in the Depression. You know, this was, what, almost 9 years after the first one?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so then, of course, why don't you start getting into the events that led up to the Second World War? Do you think he wanted to get us in the war to get us out of the Depression? Do you think that's what it was about, at least in part? Or do you think it was this idea that he wanted to lead America into this world government?
I think Franklin D. Roosevelt was an internationalist who had a vision. And I think this vision came to him when the Second World War broke out. Up until that time, Roosevelt, his conduct of foreign policy had been confusing and contradictory, and as a matter of fact, he often acted like the sort of people who are nowadays denounced as being isolationists. He couldn't really quite make up his mind whether or to what extent America ought to be committed in any of these foreign imbroglios. But then the Second World War broke out, and he saw a great opportunity. And I think he said to himself somewhere along the line, look, the United States has to play a role in this war because the results of this war are going to shape the post-war world for generations. And I believe that Franklin D. Roosevelt saw that if he could get America into the war, America could cast the decisive ballot, as it were, in the future of the war in conjunction with the Soviet Union. Because Churchill looked upon the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin as the natural allies of the United States. This may seem incredible, but in retrospect, the evidence is very strong that from the very beginning, Roosevelt said to himself, here is the Soviet Union. This is the great progressive power on this earth. Unlike the British Empire, which he looked upon as reactionary and decadent, the Soviet Union, although Joseph Stalin's methods may be crude, nonetheless represents the future hope of the world for the advancement and progress and equality of mankind. And this dovetailed with his own liberal ideology. The United States and the Soviet Union, hand in hand, would become policemen to the world. But in order for the United States to do that, it had to get into the war.
All right. Now, of course, you point out in the book that Roosevelt was surrounded by communists, people like Harry Dexter White and certainly Alger Hiss. But, of course, what most people don't understand is that Roosevelt's closest friend and advisor, Harry Hopkins, was looked upon by the Soviets as one of their major assets. Here was the man who was with the president every day, was pumping the president's mind full of ideas.
Lived in the White House for the last years of his life.
Harry Hopkins, of course, was a Soviet asset. But then, of course, it was Roosevelt so dumb and foolish he had no idea? Certainly, some people would say, gee, he just didn't know. Well, I suspect he did know. I think he saw nothing wrong with communism. In fact, when it was pointed out, there were communists in the White House, you know, at the highest echelons of our government. His response was, well, some of my best friends are communists, and I believe that. Mm-hmm. But I think that he saw nothing wrong with this horrendous concept of a ruling elite that had killed, by that time, probably close to 60 million of its own
people. Well, there's a fascinating book out by a very well-known American historian. He's a mainstream, respected historian by the name of Thomas Fleming, called The New Dealer's War. And it picks up where Pearl Harbor leaves off. It tells the story of just exactly how the war was conducted by Franklin D. Roosevelt and those around him. And one of the points that Fleming makes in this book is that Roosevelt time and again repeatedly asserted that it really didn't make any difference to him if, in fact, the communists did take over Europe.
And I think that's so important. In fact, one of the things I liked about your book was the references to all of these other very good books, some of which I had read, but some of them I hadn't read and wasn't acquainted with. And so that is really one of the great strengths of this little book, because it'll give you access to the other books that will help you to put all the pieces of the puzzle together if you're out there and you find it difficult to believe that an American president would surround himself with communists and, of course, go right along with the communist goal, because, of course, America was what preserved Russia. Russia would have been defeated readily by the Nazis had it not been for American intervention. And people say, well, we had to stop the wicked Adolf Hitler. You know, he was going to rule the world. I don't think Adolf Hitler ever had any idea of attacking America. In fact, if you read his writings, he always wanted to have America and England as his allies. But the problem certainly is that Russia, you know, was the would have been destroyed by Adolf Hitler. On the other hand, we had financed Adolf Hitler, and I'm sure you're well acquainted with Anthony Sutton's books on Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, and the fact that there's so much evidence out there that it was our industrialists and our banks that helped them prior to the war. In fact, it was Prescott Bush, the grandfather of our president, who was actually indicted for trading with the enemy during the Second World War. And that's covered in Alexander Robbins' excellent book, entitled Secrets of the Tomb. So here we have, the grandfather of the president trading with the Nazis and helping them financially. What's wrong with this picture? Well, maybe nothing is as it really appears to be. And, of course, that's because most people don't understand history. So, of course, David does an excellent job of taking us right up to the time when shortly before the Second World War broke out, and all of the machinations of President Roosevelt to force America into the war, even though he'd run promising no American boy is ever going to fight on foreign soil. I hate war. Eleanor hates war. Even little Fala hates war. Remember that? The hypocrisy of this man saying that when he was already planning on taking us into the war. But then he couldn't tell the American people the truth any more than the current administration can tell the people the truth about what the coming war is really all about. We only catch glimpses of it when David Woodward has spent a great deal of time with the president at a recent NPR interview, National Public Radio, that said that the president really told him this was all about the New World Order. But of course, you're not supposed to know that. You're supposed to think it has to do with Saddam Hussein or weapons of mass destruction or
the phantom meeting in the hotel room in Prague that never took place.
And of course, the biggest thing is we're after the oil. Well, certainly we're going to get the oil, but that's not what this is really all about. So why don't you pick up the story then of what FDR did? Because if people understand how we were manipulated into the Second World War, how the Japanese were manipulated, everybody was being manipulated by this evil little man there in the White House.
Well, what FDR did was this. Once war broke out in Europe, he suddenly changed his attitude towards Japan. The Japanese had invaded Manchuria, or Manchukuo as they called it, and took it over and made it into a province. This eventually brought them into conflict with China. The Japanese then invaded China. And for years, Roosevelt temporized as to what we ought to do about China. On the one hand, he had a certain sympathy for the Chinese. On the other hand, as it happened, Japan was our number three trading partner in the world at that time. So he also wanted to maintain good relations with China. But then the Second World War breaks out, and Japan enters into a tripartite agreement with Berlin and Rome, that is to say, with Hitler and Mussolini. This is a mutual defense pact, which obligates the members to come to each other's aid in the event that they find themselves at war with another nation or nations. And it occurs to Roosevelt that the best way to get America into war against Germany, which is his principal target, is by getting us into war with Japan, because he tried at first to provoke a series of incidents with Germany, and he had failed. There were a number of cases where American ships on the high seas were attacked by German submarines, and there were a number of incidences when American ships were actually sunk. The problem was, however, that the American ships that were sunk in the war zone which Hitler had declared. And Hitler was actually operating in compliance with international law. He had the right to sink those ships because Roosevelt gave secret orders that the United States would provide convoys for shipments of British war materials to Great Britain. This in itself, by the way, was an act of belligerency under international law, which would have justified Hitler declaring war against us. And the American people were not aware of this. Roosevelt just did it on his own authority.
And because really the American people were kept in the dark all
the
this time.
The American people that were being kept in the dark. Roosevelt, as a matter of fact, on one occasion went on radio and made his famous speech about the rattlesnakes of the sea, denouncing Hitler's submarines that were attacking American ships, and completely disregarded the fact that in most cases Hitler's submarines were perfectly justified in doing this under international law because we were acting as belligerents.
In fact,
we were providing our destroyers and destroyer escorts to convoy shipments of war material from the United States to Great Britain.
In fact, at one point you talked about the destroyer Greer that was actually radioing locations of the submarine,
threatening
a German submarine,
incident.
Telling
that was
the
rattlesnake of the sea speech. And he talked about an act of piracy on the high seas when the Lieutenant Commander Fratz's U-boat attacked the Greer. Well, the Greer, in fact, had been radioing signals to a British seaplane that had dropped depth charges against this German U-boat. The German U-boat was unable to identify the nationality of the ship. It was an old four-stacker, as they call them, a World War I era destroyer. And he had every reason to believe that it may very well have been a British ship because we had just sold, or rather given, to Great Britain in exchange for some use of some naval bases in the Antilles, 50 U.S. destroyers. So here's this U-boat commander, and all of a sudden he's being attacked by depth charges. He looks through his periscope, and he sees a ship, which for all he knew could very well be a British ship. And he draws the conclusion, which was quite logical, that he had been attacked by depth charges from this ship. So he fires a torpedo at it. But Roosevelt edited all that down to the simple assertion that a German U-boat had attacked an American ship with a torpedo on the high seas, which is true.
but it was only part of the truth and extremely misleading. That's just a good example of the sort of manipulation that Roosevelt was involved in trying to provoke a public response so that the American people would demand that we go to war against Germany. But the problem is that Hitler did not rise to the bait. Hitler gave orders to his U-boat commanders not to attack American vessels outside of the war zone. And an incident never occurred where there was sufficient loss of American life under circumstances where it was unequivocally an act of German aggression to provoke American public opinion into saying we ought to go to war against Germany. And it was as a result of that failure to provoke Hitler, I think, that Roosevelt became ever more interested in turning towards Japan and getting us into a war through the back door. Because if he could get Japan to attack us, then it was a reasonable assumption that Germany would come to Japan's aid through the tripartite treaty and declare war against us, which in fact they did.
Well, you know, I think that there were so many interesting aspects of this whole story as it unfolds. And, of course, the major thing was to deceive the American people. Don't let them know that our leaders were intent upon war. Make it appear that it was the Germans that were really responsible for this. One of the things that you talked about, which I had never heard before, was these Mary Noel Fathers and how they were used as intermediaries to try to work out a peace agreement with the Japanese. The only trouble was should have been very obvious that we did not want peace, we wanted war. Could you tell that story and how frustrated the Japanese were and the major concessions they were willing to make, like pulling out of China and certainly not asking for any reparations?
Asking for any reparations. They were willing to withdraw from China over a period of 3 years, and what they wanted was simply to negotiate new agreements that will permit them to amplify their trade with the United States. They used the Maryknoll Fathers, who had missions in China, as emissaries to Roosevelt's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, and Hull did nothing but stall over a period of months. They would meet with him and try to get him to at least pay serious attention to their proposals, and they were never able to get him to do that. And as a result of that, finally, the Prime Minister of Japan at that time, Prince Konoye, lost faith. And I believe the day was on the 2nd of October that Hull handed Nomura, who was the Japanese ambassador in Washington, a note stating that there could be no meeting between Konoye and Roosevelt unless there was a basic agreement on policy between them beforehand, and of course that is exactly what they were trying to negotiate. So as a result of that, Konoye fell from power, and the militarists under General Tojo came to power. And the great opportunity that we had to negotiate a peaceful settlement of the war between China and Japan disappeared.
Well, it's so reminiscent, of course, of what happened before we attacked Afghanistan. You know, we said, give us Osama bin Laden, and they said, well, we'll give you Osama bin Laden, just show us the proof of he was involved, and we said, we don't have to show you the truth, give us Osama bin Laden. So they said, look, we'll send Osama bin Laden to another country, and he can be tried. We didn't want that. They said, look, we'll just force him out of the country, and, you know, if he's leaving the country, we can pick him up.
Non-negotiable demand.
Non-negotiable.
That's what it comes down to. Well, you know, we are sort of involved in the same sort of thing right now with Iraq, because we are telling them that you have to produce, we want you to produce your weapons of mass destruction, and they come up with a 12,000-page report that says, in essence, they don't have any, and we're not going to believe them. It doesn't make any difference how many thousands of pages of documentation they produce. Our position is always going to be, well, they've got them, they're lying to us, and they're hiding them.
Well, of course, it was the same thing with Afghanistan. What we said was, well, we want you not, we're not even interested in Osama bin Laden. We want all the Al-Qaeda terrorists. We want every member of Al-Qaeda turned over to us. Well, the trouble was that most members of Al-Qaeda weren't in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We didn't give them the list of who we wanted them to turn over. I mean, they were willing to, you know, to negotiate something with it.
Well, we made impossible demands.
That's what it's
Roosevelt
all about.
Made impossible demands on the Japanese because after Konoye fell from power and Tojo came to power, there was a period of time where Roosevelt reconsidered his position and actually dangled in front of the Japanese a modus vivendi, which in effect said, look, what we will do is we'll consider relaxing our embargo that we have placed against you, especially the embargo on oil, which was critical to the Japanese. But then Roosevelt did on the 25th of November an about-face, 180-degree turn, and all of a sudden we came up with the following demands. The Japanese must withdraw all of their forces from China immediately, and the Japanese must break their tripartite agreement with Tokyo and Rome. Now, these were totally unacceptable demands.
Well, we're going to have to interrupt you. We'll be right back here after the break, and we'll continue with David Waite and his book, Infamy Revisited. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you're out there in the listening audience, why we just want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs, who are concerned about our country, who are concerned about our freedom, who are concerned about our families and our freedom, to join with us in this epic struggle to try to educate the American people. Because if the American people don't understand that the media is controlled, that there is censorship in America, that it's very difficult through the regular channels to get the truth out. Now, we do have the opportunity through the Internet and alternative radio and shortwave to reach people we never did before, but we've got to get them tuning into the Internet, where, of course, our Internet site, RadioLiberty.com, you can listen to us 5 hours a day. Of course, you won't get anything accomplished. 3 hours on Radio Liberty, an hour on the AmericanNewsNet.com, an hour on Genesis, GCNLive.com. You go to our website, and there's all that information is available there. You have to know who you can trust, because there's all sorts of CIA disinformation on the Internet. It's put up there intentionally to mislead people or to confuse them or to make them think that we're fighting some different conspiracy. Maybe it's a Jewish conspiracy or a Catholic conspiracy. And there are all these things up on the net to confuse you intentionally so you won't understand what this is really all about. And we will try to bring you to a real understanding of what this is about. And, of course, that's covered in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. But this book that we're talking about this evening, Infamy Revisited, is an excellent, excellent book. And, of course, if you would like to learn more about it, a suggested donation, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for Infamy Revisited, the book we're talking about this evening. And we recommend it to you if you are interested in really understanding the history of the past. Because without an understanding of the history of the past, why, you can't understand really what's going on in the world today. And then, of course, we hope many of you out there want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And for a suggested gift, why you'll be able to join the Radio Liberty family and get our 4 best tapes of the month and our monthly newsletter. Or some people just to take the newsletter. But whatever you can do, we'll appreciate it, because it will help us to continue as we are now, reaching out across America on almost 50 outlets every single week. But believe me, it's expensive, but we feel it's worthwhile, because after all, if America's lost, what will anything really matter at that point? We've lived in this most wonderful of all countries. I've lived here for almost 74 years. I love this country, and I'm spending my time, my retirement, trying to educate others to understanding the Christian foundation of this country and the fact that from the very inception of this nation, there were always dark forces here, organizations dedicated to taking over a control of our government, and they did. They took over control during the regime of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and of course, he led us into the Second World War, and then, of course, subsequently, we had the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Gulf War, and we lost every one of them. They say, we won the Gulf War. No, we didn't. Saddam Hussein remained in power, and of course, George Herbert Walker Bush, the president, was forced out of power. Saddam Hussein was allowed to win the war. We left him in power intentionally, because I believe that this is all scripted. Everything is long-range planning, which is why the current administration is so intent upon taking us into another war, which I believe may well lead to the Third World War, which will have frightening and horrible repercussions for everybody listening to this program. So our hope is that many of you out there will decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us to educate people across America. Again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because, of course, we are at war today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is David Wade, and we're talking about his excellent book, which is really so apropos right now, because you have to understand the past and how the American people were betrayed during getting us into the Second World War to understand what's going on today and how this was covered up, an investigation after investigation after investigation, but the American people were never to be allowed to learn the truth. So, I mean, one of the major things that, of course, that the Roosevelt did, which was really an act of war, was the various embargoes we put on Japan. Would you like to talk about that, David?
Oh, well, yes. As a matter of fact, the embargoes against Japan, we froze Japanese assets, which made it impossible for them to conduct international trade with us, and we embargoed the sale of oil to Japan. This was really crucial, of course, because the Japanese economy and the Japanese war machine would grind to a rusty halt within a matter of months without American exports. And they were well aware of this. The embargo of oil against Japan was a greater blow to them than bombing Tokyo would have been.
It was really an act of war, but the American people didn't understand that.
Well, no, because at the time there were a lot of other things going on. And the American people, even more so than now in those days, paid very little attention to the conduct of the nation's foreign policy. They trusted their government, and they were more concerned with domestic issues, the economy, who was going to win the World Series, whatever. Very little attention was paid to what was going on in the Pacific, much less so even than what was going on in Europe.
And I think, you know, the analogies of what's going on in Afghanistan, it's estimated that we've killed over 500,000 Iraqi children, by the embargo,
by the bombing.
And,
yes.
We've been bombing Iraq regularly for the last 3 or 4 years, at least 2 or 3 times a week. But those are peaceful bombs, you must understand. And then those wicked Iraqis, why they fire at our planes. Can you imagine that? I mean, our
That's
peaceful
right.
planes flying over there, and they fire at them. Well, I think if Saddam was really smart, he would just say, don't bother to fire at them. My fear is he's going to shoot down one of our planes, and we'll use that as a justification for going to war.
And
or if he doesn't
he
do it,
why? He hasn't succeeded in doing so after all this period of time, and yet we are supposed to believe that he is a grave threat to the United States of America. There's an interesting contradiction because these chicken hawks in Washington who are so anxious for a war against Iraq keep trying to convince us that it's going to be a pushover because Saddam Hussein is a fifth-rate military power. And yet, on the other hand, he's supposed to be a grave and immediate threat to our very survival as a nation because of all of these weapons of mass destruction that he has. The only thing I can say is that if, in fact, he does have biochemical weapons, the best way to find out whether he does or not is to invade his country, and then we'll know.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Nathan, who's calling in here. Hi, Nathan. How are you?
Yes, good evening. Well, I have 2 points to make. First of all, yes, we did embargo Japan, but they had invaded a sovereign country. I don't think that we should just have countries invading sovereign countries, and I understand that we did it in Panama, and I believe that was wrong. And I think that, you know, there should definitely be the same standard applied to us, too, but I don't think that Japan should have had the right to invade and murder Chinese people, and I also believe that I've read Adolf Hitler's writings, the primary source documents, and it seems to be very clear to me that although, yes, he was helped into power by the invisible rulers behind the scenes, that he was not necessarily fond of them, and that he wanted to rule the world in his own right, in his own form of satanic world dictatorship. So I don't entirely agree with what your guest is saying, Doctor. I think there's some, definitely we are run by the, what you could call the war party. I do understand that, and I do understand that we're run by the internationalists, the CFR or what have you, but I don't necessarily think that I don't believe that a nation that doesn't defend itself or a nation that doesn't have some degree of a martial tradition, i.e. for self-defense, of course, is going to be anything other than a pushover in the world, and that's how it seems to me.
Well, Nathan, just in response to that, I agree with you. I think that most Mr. Wade and I would both agree with you. Did we do everything we could to get Japan to attack us? In other words, did we put an oil embargo on them?
I believe we did, and my specific response to his comment would be, first, if we were concerned primarily about Japan's aggression against China, we would have taken the opportunity that we had seriously to negotiate with them to end it, which we did not, point one. Point two, the embargo against Japan was not a direct response to Japan's aggression in China, I don't believe. It came from the memo of Commander Arthur H. McCollum. And if you've had the opportunity to interview Robert Stinnett, you probably recall who Arthur H. McCollum was. He wrote an 8-point memo in October of 1940 outlining exactly what we had to do in order to provoke Japan to attack us. And a copy of this memo appears in Stinnett's book. One of those points was we had to embargo Japan. So I look upon our embargo not as an attempt to compel Japan to stop its invasion of China, but to provoke Japan to attack us.
Okay, I think that's well put. Anything else you want to say, Nathan?
Well, I don't necessarily. I do know that the Mexican War was provoked, and I do know that this has happened before in history, but I should just say that let us assume for a minute that, by the way, I wrote down Arthur H. McCollum, and I will look into it, but let's assume for a minute, just for the sake of argument, though, that it was a response to Japan's invasion of China, and let's just go with that thread for a moment. I don't believe, if that were the case, I don't believe in negotiating with them to sort of just give them what they want. That's just going to embolden them. I think that, you know, given that scenario, I believe that force should have been exerted by the League of God-fearing and law-abiding nations right then and there. Now, obviously, there may be this other possibility, and I don't want to discount it. For one thing, we were trading with them, and
right.
It seems like every single nation that we have a favored trading status with, we eventually go to war. Hopefully, China, you know, hopefully we can head that one off at the pass.
Let me just suggest that this is an inexpensive book. It's easy reading, and I think it is a very important contribution because it really summarizes so many other very, very valid books, and of course, it stands on its own. So, Infamy Revisited, read that, and then maybe we could discuss again, okay?
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. And that was Nathan calling from Contra Costa. And, of course, the idea, of course, if somebody is invading another country, well, then if by that same token, the Russians have invaded Chechnya, we should go to war with Russia.
Well, yeah, by logical extension, the United States would be at war all the time, everywhere.
And certainly the Chinese invaded Tibet, and they're still holding it. We should go to war with China.
Absolutely. And look what's been going on in the Sudan and what's been going on in... Indonesia, and
certainly we should be in the Congo. We should certainly, go to war with Rhodesia, and we could just go on and on and on and on.
And certainly in terms of an immediate threat to the security of the United States, for instance, North Korea constitutes a much greater immediate threat than Iraq does. But there are reasons in history why we decide to select the wars that we do. And in the case of Iraq and also in the case of Japan, I don't think it was because we said, aha, these are aggressor nations, these are threats to our national security, or these are nations who have transgressed international law by invading other nations, and therefore, willy-nilly, we're going to go to war with them. No, that wasn't it.
No,
there were other factors that determined the decision. Have to do, interestingly enough, in both cases, you're talking about oil, aren't you? An American embargo of oil to Japan, and our control of oil as a geopolitical asset in the Middle East.
Well, I don't think anybody can justify Japanese invasion of either Korea or China.
No, but, Japan was clearly an aggressor nation. However, I do make the point that we did have an opportunity to negotiate with them because there was a party in Japan at that time that was weary of the war in China that had now gone on for years and had consumed the lives of hundreds of thousands of their best soldiers. And we should have encouraged them because there were those in Japan who were looking for an out. Who wanted to wind down the war in China. But we didn't. And as I say, if Roosevelt was so concerned about ending aggression in China, why didn't he instruct Cordell Hull seriously to consider, for instance, the Marinol proposals?
And I think that this is something I learned from your book. I'd never heard of the Marinol proposals before, and the book is certainly worth the price.
Yeah, well, Charles... Tansel's book, Backdoor to War, which is an old classic. It was written, I think, 1949. One of the first of the revisionist studies of Pearl Harbor goes into that subject in great depth.
And, of course, what people don't understand is the great tax-exempt foundations and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rockefellers bought up a lot of historians, put their people into chairs at the major universities, and wrote the history of the Second World War so the American people would never know the truth. And, in fact, Charles Beard, Austin Beard, wrote an article for Saturday Evening Post, and we have it somewhere around, but the article is reproduced in the book... Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace
by Harry Barnes.
And he basically says exactly what I said. Charles Austin Beard, certainly the most revered historian of the first half of the 20th century, let it be quite clear that the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rockefeller Foundation did not want the American people to learn the truth about the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's pick up this story about the oil embargo, because we embargoed oil, we embargoed steel, we embargoed metals, we embargoed all sorts of raw materials to the Japanese. These were all acts of war. When you put an embargo on a country, isn't that an act of war?
Yes, it is. And there were other acts of war, not just the embargoes, but I mean, we were secretly negotiating with the British, the Dutch, the Chinese, the Canadians, for use of their harbors. And there's no doubt, I think, that the meeting that took place between Churchill and Roosevelt at Argentia Bay, the so-called Atlantic Charter meeting, was in effect an unconstitutional treaty that Roosevelt concluded with Churchill.
Yeah, that was the Four Freedoms. Was it freedom from fear and freedom from...
Freedom from want, freedom of religion, and freedom of speech everywhere in the world, which was very fine, but I think that was really window dressing for what went on secretly at that meeting.
And that was planning for the war and to take us into the war that would cost us several hundred thousand.
Yeah, Churchill let the cat out of the bag later on during the cabinet meeting when he told his cabinet ministers, you know, he was absolutely elated. He had come back from the meeting there off the coast of Newfoundland and aboard the Prince of Wales. And he said, Roosevelt has promised me to get America into the war one way or the other, even without declaring it. Now, under our Constitution, a treaty has to be ratified by the Senate of the United States. And this was a very solemn agreement that Roosevelt and Churchill had entered into, and it wasn't. And, of course, also under our Constitution, you are required to get a declaration of war from the elected representatives of the people. And this was something else that Roosevelt secretly circumvented. You know, in a way, Pearl Harbor really, really saved Franklin D. Roosevelt. It saved his bacon. Because if the Japanese had attacked the British in the Pacific without also at the same time attacking us at Pearl Harbor and also in the Philippines and Guam and Wake, then he really would have had a dilemma, because he gave this pledge to Churchill. If the Japanese attack you in the Pacific, I'll get in the war with you.
And of course, I think the...
Without a declaration of war by Congress, and that would have exposed him to the possibility of being impeached.
Well, I think that people have to understand the American people didn't want to go to war. And the American people knew that they'd been betrayed, brought into the First World War by a lot of propaganda, and none of it was true.
Yes, well, that was the reason why there was such a... Although the majority of the American people wanted to aid Great Britain, 80% of them, in most public opinion polls that I have seen, the figure usually fluctuates right around 80%, did not want American armies involved in a shooting war abroad again. Because we had gone through that, there had been 90,000 Americans that were killed in a relatively short period of time of our involvement in the First World War. And we fought the First World War to make the world safe for democracy. It was going to be the war to end all wars, and what happened? Within a generation, there was another great war that broke out in Europe.
You mean they lied to us?
Well, let's say they overpromised.
Oh, right, fine. Well, of course, the thing is that it's all lies. I mean, a government always has plausible deniability. The whole idea is, how do you rule the people without let them understand that they really is a ruling elite? They have to make the American people feel that the government is represents the people, that we have a representative government. No, we have a ruling elite, and of course, we have a lot of congressmen there in Washington, D.C., senators, the finest congressmen and senators that money can buy. And
that.
It's about time the American people got involved and got people into office who represent them rather than the power elite that rules the world. Well, let's get on then into the events that led up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, because that really is so vitally important to understand the ultimate betrayal and the leaving of those boys there to die. So we'd have a great slogan, Remember Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, we have a great slogan, Remember Pearl Harbor. And I mentioned earlier how Roosevelt did a 180-degree turn on his negotiating stance with the Japanese and came up with these unacceptable demands, immediate withdrawal from China, withdrawal from the tripartite pact with Berlin and Rome. It's interesting that this turn came on the 25th of November,
1941. That's 1941,
and that was right at the time that the Japanese fleet left home waters, headed toward Hawaii, and also at the time when Roosevelt received a mysterious late-night message from Churchill that purported to complain about Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists not receiving sufficient aid. And also at that very same date, when he would have received a warning, the only warning he actually got from Admiral Kimmel in Hawaii, to the effect that our cryptographers on Oahu had intercepted messages from a large contingent of Japanese submarines, which would have been the vanguard of Kido Butai, the Japanese strike force. Now, Kimmel received this message from Joseph Rochefort, who was a lieutenant commander in charge of Station Hypo in Oahu. But it was the only message that Kimmel received, because right after he got that message, a message came out from Arthur H. McCollum, no less, that said, from now on, no interceptions are to be given to Admiral Kimmel.
Now, where is that documented?
That is documented in Stinnett's book.
Okay, fine. Lieutenant Commander McCollum was the man who had, of course, told Roosevelt.
Right.
How
to provoke the author of the notorious McCollum memo.
And it's all
told Roosevelt exactly what we had to do in order to go to war with Japan. He sent a message that said, no more interceptions are to be given to Kimmel. So that was the only interception that Kimmel actually received. He passed it on to Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt, in addition to this, however, had received any number of other interceptions from Station Cast in the Philippines, which was under the command of Commander Dwayne Whitlock. And then he also received from the 12th U.S. Naval District in San Francisco additional interceptions of a large number of Japanese radio messages in the North Pacific, which could only indicate a big fleet, and there could only be one plausible target, which would have been our Pacific fleet on Ford Island, Battleship Row, Oahu, and Hawaii.
Now, I understand that somewhere along the line here, Admiral Kimmel actually, first of all, was ordered to send the carriers off someplace, which meant, of course, he put the ship, his battleships to sea that have no air cover. But after the aircraft carriers had been ordered out of Pearl Harbor, then Admiral Kimmel actually did put his ships to sea and was
yes.
told to return them
yes,
immediately?
There was, yes, because there was also what was called the vacant sea order that was issued by the Chief of Naval Operations, another close friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's, Admiral Harold Stark. All American vessels in the North Pacific were to return to port, and Kimmel was actually out on maneuvers. He sent his fleet out on maneuvers to get ready for a possible attack. And they were ordered back, and they were told to stay at Pearl Harbor until further notice.
And, of course, at the same time,
the order came, around the same time, the order came from McCollum that hereinafter, Kimmel was to receive no more transcripts of any interceptions of Japanese radio messages.
But they knew that the fleet was moving towards Pearl Harbor.
They knew
that the
fleet was
exactly
moving towards Pearl Harbor. And the big breakthrough in recent historical investigation into Pearl Harbor is that we have now disproven what had been believed for years, namely that the Japanese fleet maintained radio silence. There was an order from Admiral Yamamoto to maintain radio silence, but we now know that it was broken, that the Japanese Fleet Kido Butai did, in fact, send and receive many different messages. There was a total of 844 messages that Admiral Nagumo initiated during the time prior to the Pearl Harbor attack.
We're going to have to interrupt you here. We're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the great state of, certainly of Washington and western Idaho, northern Oregon. And, of course, we'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to have another hour. If you'd like to have more information on getting that second hour, of course, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America, and remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So we'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that a reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask that you, of course, hold your calls for the time being because there's a lot more that we need to discuss here with our guests. Our guest is David Wade. His book, Infamy Revisited, Another Look at Pearl Harbor. And of course, we feel this is such an important book because you need to understand the techniques that have been used in the past to manipulate America into war, to understand what's going on here in the United States today as we are being manipulated into war. Do you realize that just a couple of weeks ago, there were 200,000 people demonstrating at the White House? You remember reading about that in the newspapers or seeing the pictures on television night after night after night? And my producer types in the screen, nope. And people aren't hearing about it. All sorts of demonstrations. People don't want to go to war. But, of course, you're supposed to get the idea that there's tremendous, tremendous support out across America for this wonderful, wonderful idea of course, taking down the wicked Saddam Hussein. And he is a wicked man. No question at all he's a wicked man. But he's the wicked man that we put into power, that we kept in power, and that we left in power in 1991. And then when the Iraqi military tried to overthrow him in 1995, and that's covered in Robert Baer's book, See No Evil. why, of course, we betrayed the Iraqi military. So, in fact, Robert Baer comments that there are many, many people in Iraq who believe Saddam Hussein is a CIA agent. In fact, I just came across an article in the New York Times sort of ridiculing the idea that all these crazy Iraqis think that Saddam Hussein is a CIA agent. Now, I'm not suggesting he is, but I'm suggesting that an awful lot of people in Iraq thinks he is because they know he's been supported consistently by the American government. All the time we're dropping bombs on him, but then, after all, remember, we brought Fidel Castro to power, and we have kept Fidel Castro in power, and, of course, we keep our embargo on him to make the lives of the Cuban people miserable. But whatever time that Fidel Castro comes to the United States to address the United Nations, he stops off to see his good friend, David Rockefeller. Well, things are never as they appear to be. So let's get back to David's story of infamy. And, of course, what he's pointing out is the fact that it is now apparent, because of the hard work of Robert Stinnett in his book, A Day of Deceit, that our government was tracking the Japanese fleet across the Pacific because we had access to the radio transmits. And you know that to this very day, most of this information is still classified. Robert Stinnett, with a great deal of difficulty, was able to get enough to piece together the story. You pick up the story from there, David.
Freedom of Information, Freedom of Information Act requests, and quite frequently they were turned down, and in some cases they were honored, and it's absolutely inscrutable why in some cases they're turned down and other cases they are honored.
Well, you'd be glad to know that President Bush has told the government officials not to honor any Freedom of Information Act requests, that he will back them up. They're not to obey the law. They are simply not to give out any information. If there's nothing to hide, why is the Bush administration so intent upon hiding?
Well, it would seem that there would be a lot to hide, and we can take Pearl Harbor as an example of that, because one of the very first orders that was issued after the attack on Pearl Harbor was to destroy everything in writing that had to do with the attack or leading up to the attack. And this came from the Office of Naval Operations in Washington, D.C. And let me give another example. There was a assistant telegrapher aboard a commercial freighter, the SS Lurline. His name was Leslie Grogan.
Now, that was a passenger liner, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a passenger liner. It was in the North Pacific, and Grogan was one of the men who first began to intercept Japanese radio transmissions from their strike force. Now, of course, he could not decode them, but he knew enough to know that they were Japanese. And he also knew that there were a lot of them, and it indicated the presence of a very large fleet out there. And in fact, there were 6 aircraft carriers, 2 battleships, a large number of cruisers, submarines, tankers, and Admiral Nagumo's strike force was a formidable armada. He was bound towards Hawaii. When he arrived there, after the attack took place, officials of the U.S. Navy boarded his ship and seized his logs. And guess what? To this day, we don't know what happened to them. They were supposed to have ended up in the Naval Archives, but the place where they were supposed to be is vacant, and that someone stuck a little card there saying that they had been checked out, without, however, indicating who it was that checked them out, which incidentally is a violation of naval security procedures. And to this day, they're missing. And not only that, but Commander Elwin Kramer is another character in this melodrama. He was one of the people to whom was entrusted the famous Nakashi Kazigo Ami message, which in Japanese means west wind rain, an indication, or east wind rain, an indication that Japan was going to go to war with the United States. So this was known. This code had been cracked, and we knew that that was the code the Japanese would send when war between the United States and Japan was imminent.
Now, wasn't that so that all the embassies would destroy all the records, things like that?
Yeah, right, exactly. That's why the message went out, east wind rain. This message was... there are any number of people that swore to it, that they actually saw this message, and Elwin Kramer supposedly had a copy of it in his safe. Well, that has disappeared too, and has never been found. There were some 67 so-called cleansed monographs that were sent to President Franklin D. Roosevelt through his naval routing officer, and guess who that was? Commander Arthur H. McCollum. And we know that the monographs were sent. There's a record that they were sent. But their content has been excised. They're blank. Anything having to do with Pearl Harbor is missing from them. And to this day, no accounting has ever been made of them. The only message that we know directly that Roosevelt received about Pearl Harbor that we actually have a record of is the message that Kimmel sent him by way of Rochefort, and that message managed to sneak its way through just before McCollum sent a directive saying no more interceptions are to be shared with Admiral Kimmel. That's the only one, but we know that there were others. We don't know their content. We know that they existed, but because we have a record that they were sent, but the actual messages themselves have all been excised.
Well, of course, there were some things, though, that they hadn't been able to excise. One of them, of course, was the message that was sent from a Danish diplomat to his own country, to Denmark, about a day or so before the attack, the day before the attack. What was it? He was at the Office of Naval Operations in Washington, D.C., and they showed him on the chart exactly where the Japanese fleet
was. Oh, yes, he was
there. Why don't you tell that story?
Yeah,
that's a fascinating story.
There was a joint, his country and Sweden had jointly manufactured an anti-aircraft gun, and he was there settling a patent dispute, and he happened to wander in to Office of Naval Operations on Connecticut Avenue, where indeed he saw naval officers standing by a map, and one of them pointing to it and saying, "This is the position of the Japanese fleet, some several hundred miles to the northwest of Hawaii at that time." So they knew the fleet was there. And as a matter of fact, the Dutch, who had also broken the Japanese Purple Code in Indonesia, concluded that an attack was going to come on Pearl Harbor within 48 hours. And they were absolutely flabbergasted to discover that we were taken by surprise.
Well, I think
we knew it was coming.
I think what's so interesting is that John Toland, who wrote the book Infamy back in the early 80s, actually tracked this story down, and he actually got the documents from Denmark to make sure it was absolutely correct. But, of course, all of this has to be concealed from the American people because we must never be allowed to know that they knew what was coming and they left those boys there to die. That is what is so important today. As we look at the terrible tragedy that occurred at the World Trade Center, and of course some people say, why weren't there any planes in the air? An hour and 40 minutes from the time the first plane was hijacked till the third plane crashed into the Pentagon, and not one American fighter plane was put in the air to intercept these planes? And anybody knows that somebody gave an order that those planes were not to be in the air.
You would think, just common sense. I mean, they had tried to attack the World Trade Center before.
Absolutely, and they knew it was coming. In fact, I have a friend. His name is Garth Nicholson. He's been a frequent guest on our programs. He was told several weeks beforehand by FBI agents who were afraid to come forward for fear it would cost them their careers and perhaps even their lives. But they told him that on the 11th of September there would be an attack on the Pentagon. And he actually notified people at the highest echelons of government. I've talked to Garth. He's told me this. I have interviewed him many, many times on other subjects. I believe he's an honest man. David Shippers has a very, very similar story to tell. He went to Washington 6 weeks ahead of time.
Yes, I know David Shippers.
To try to get the people. He couldn't get to Ashcroft. He knew Ashcroft, but Ashcroft would not talk to him. He tried to get to the people, the leaders of Congress, and they wouldn't talk to him. He knew them all because he had been in charge of the committee that had impeached Bill Clinton in the House of Representatives. So he was very well known. He was very well respected. And David Shippers is trying to let people know there's an attack coming on America. And for some reason, they didn't want to know that the attack was coming in September. And this is what he was saying. It's going to be early September. It's going to be on Lower Manhattan. And so there's so much evidence that they knew ahead of time.
Yes.
But we can't let the American people know that.
When I expound on my views of Roosevelt and Pearl Harbor, I'm frequently met with the objection that, after all, Roosevelt may have been duplicitous, but he wasn't a monster, and he wouldn't have deliberately exposed all those thousands of servicemen to a sneak attack if he had information and he could have warned them. But what I like to say in rebuttal to this is, are you aware of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Order number 1067, which was issued later in the war on the 17th of September, I believe it was, 1944. This is one of these footnotes of history which has been forgotten about because victors write the history. This was a Joint Chief of Staff order that was issued while Roosevelt was president, and undoubtedly he had to know about it. It had to have been done with his knowledge and consent. Nothing this important would have been done without the knowledge and consent of the commander-in-chief. And it instituted Operation Keelhaul, which forcibly repatriated some 2 million refugees from Stalin's tyranny back to the Soviet Union, where most of them were probably either worked to death in prison camps or shot for having deserted. And this was one of the great crimes of the Second World War. But one can see that Roosevelt would have consented to something like this because he wanted to make nice with Joe Stalin. And he did just about everything he could to appease Stalin because he had this vision that he and Stalin in the post-war world would become the co-founders of this new world order. And would a man who would not scruple to turn 2 million people back to the tender mercies of Joseph Stalin not risk the lives of a few thousand American servicemen in Hawaii in order to realize his great vision?
And, of course, some people think the figure is as high as 6 million. That was the Joseph Epstein's figure. I have the article out of the Wall Street Journal.
Count Leo Tolstoy.
Right, and, of course, Secret Betrayal talks about actually 5.5 million. We had one article out of the Wall Street Journal. I can't find it. Mentioned 6 million. The most recent article I have mentions 2 or 2.5 million, as you say. Any of our listeners out there would like a little pamphlet on Operation Keelhaul.
I'd like that myself.
Well, fine. You give me a call. You know how to reach me, and we'll get that to you. In fact, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll send you a copy of the video on Operation Keelhaul.
Oh, excellent.
And this has been, it was only shown one time in the United States, and then somebody put the order. This was never to be shown again. It was never shown again in the United States. Why?
Yes, this is one of the deep, dark secrets of the war. I am familiar with a book on the subject by Nikolai Tolstoy, who is...
Right, that's Secret Betrayal.
Yeah, exactly, yes. I heard him lecture once.
And there were two other books. One was called Operation Keelhaul by Julius Epstein, and the other was East Came West. And we'll send you the material on all of those.
Really?
You give me a call, and we'll get that for you.
Okay.
Okay, but go ahead, because I think that's so vitally important. And your point is, if they weren't concerned about repatriating 2 million, or 6 million, doesn't really matter, but 2 million of Russians that they knew would be killed, why should we think that they would be concerned about letting 3,000 boys die?
The lives of a few thousand sailors, if in fact he was willing to condemn millions of innocent people to Stalin.
And, of course, we know that we abandoned 25,000 American boys after the Second World War to die in Siberia, and, of 8,000 after Korea, and about 3,000 after Vietnam. And, in fact, we even abandoned one of our flyers after the Gulf War, a commander, what was his name, Spiker. And we knew he was shot down and taken prisoner by the Iraqis. But of course, we wrote him off as dead until recently, when we needed some excuse for going to war with Iraq. So we recently reclassified him. We brought him back from the dead and said he isn't dead; he's missing in action. And the wicked Saddam Hussein has him, and that's why we got to go to war. And he may very well be still there, rotting in a prison someplace, or maybe they'll execute him. Saddam, in a fit of anger. But here's a young man, ready to fight and die for his country. Mm-hmm. But, of course, never willing to be betrayed by his country.
I guess what I'm saying is that there is a certain level of power politics where people do not think the way we do. And the normal moral evaluations that we make do not apply.
I think that's so important. That there are people who look at the world differently, who have a different set of morals, who dream a different dream.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, of course, your contention is that they knew the attack was coming, and of course we specifically did not warn Admiral Kimmel or General.
Not only did we not warn him, deliberate steps were taken to make sure that he was kept in the dark.
What about the order to go on sabotage alert in Pearl Harbor? Why was that important?
Well, because it's often been said that that Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and General Walter Short were derelict in their duty. And you have to remember that although they did receive war warnings, first, these war warnings were very general. They didn't say anything specifically about an attack on Pearl Harbor. And second, the war warnings have to be read in the context of two additional admonitions. The first one was that, as far as General Short was concerned, he should be primarily interested in sabotage, because there are a lot of Japanese Americans on the island of Hawaii. And also that nothing should be done to disturb the civilian population, which is kind of contradictory. I mean, any serious attempts to place Hawaii on a war footing and prepare for a possible attack could conceivably be interpreted as disturbing the civilian population. So Short really didn't know quite what to make of that order, but he did have a strict admonition to prepare against sabotage, which is what he did. And that's why he took all the planes and he lined them up wingtip to wingtip to make it harder for anyone to infiltrate the airstrips and sabotage the airplane.
And make them really such a wonderful target for the plane.
But by doing that, he made them all the easier as targets to be hit from the air by Japanese bombers.
And that, of course, you say, could they really be that evil? And I would like to suggest they knew exactly what they were doing. But, of course, then they needed the scapegoats, and that was Admiral Kimmel and General Short. And, of course, I'm sure you probably read Admiral Kimmel's story. It is, he wrote the book, and he was getting all these personal letters from Admiral Stark back in Washington, D.C., saying, oh, yeah, the war, well, if it comes, it's going to come in the Philippines. It's not going to be there in at Pearl Harbor. And everything was done with these regular letters from the Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, D.C., working with Roosevelt to convince Admiral Kimmel that the attack was not going to come on Pearl Harbor.
It is true that there were war warnings. But they have to be placed in the context of everything else that they were being told, and also within the context of everything that they were not being told. No big thing about the war warning, because everybody who was in the know at all knew that the United States and Japan would be very shortly going to war. It was an inevitable conclusion from where we've been conducting our foreign policy. But specifically, the question is, did we know that Pearl Harbor was going to be the target? And the answer is Roosevelt certainly knew, and Stark and Marshall and other key figures around him.
Stimson, right.
But the ones that needed most to know about this, Kimmel and Short, weren't told.
And, of course, this, I think, is criminal negligence. But then, of course, you needed a fall guy. And, of course, that that would be certainly Admiral Kimmel and General Short. One of the things that, before we get much further, would be the war plans that were leaked to General McCormick in the Chicago Tribune. And I had an opportunity one time to spend several weekends with Admiral Wedemeyer, who was in charge of planning for the Second World War.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Among their plans was a plan that to mobilize and put a 10 million man army together, mm-hmm. something like that, to attack Germany if we went to war. So this was part of the contingency plan.
Yeah.
It was all laid out. It was
and people innocently defend it by saying, well, after all, we have to have contingencies for any eventuality, and this is just normal planning. Well, it's difficult to imagine any contingency that would have made it necessary for us to plan have 10 million men involved in an invasion of Europe, unless you are presupposing that we were definitely going to get into that war, and we were going to get into that war on our own initiative because we had already tried to provoke Hitler and hadn't been successful. So, if we were planning for the defense of the United States from a foreign invasion, that would have been a different thing, but the plan was for an invasion of Europe.
Well, I, what's so interesting is that this plan was stolen from General MacArthur's safe, and given to a copy was given to General McCormick, who ran the Chicago Tribune,
and then
of course it was on the headlines of our newspapers just a few days before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and of course this way Adolf Hitler would know about our military plans. It was really done to inflame Adolf Hitler. But of course immediately after this was released, General Wedemeyer was investigated. It was said, well, he obviously must be the person who leaked this. He must be pro-German. He's trying to let the Germans know what our secret war plans are. Do you want to pick up that story? Because I think it's fascinating.
Now, here we get into a case where there's a certain amount of circumstantial evidence and speculation. We really don't have a smoking gun, but I thought it was interesting that Richard Norton Smith, who is a very credible biographer and historian, and he's written a great biography of Colonel Robert Rutherford McCormick. Smith seems to think that Roosevelt himself was behind this, because Roosevelt was deliberately trying to discredit McCormick. Roosevelt knew that the war was going to come within a matter of days anyway. And so if McCormick leaked the story about how we were preparing for an invasion of Europe, it would look like McCormick was being disloyal, that he, in other words, was publicizing our military secrets in time of war. And therefore, this would make McCormick look like a dastardly individual who had committed an act of treason. And there's every reason to believe that how the plans got from Wedemeyer's safe to the hands of Senator Burton K. Wheeler was through the through the machinations of Franklin D. Roosevelt himself.
Well, in the book A Man Called Intrepid by William Stevenson,
yeah.
who a different William Stevenson that the topic of the book is.
But right.
There
it's
it actually
coincidental
says,
that the man right. who wrote the book has the same last name as the subject of the book, yeah.
But actually in that book it says that Roosevelt, actually he had a copy of them, and he was the one that actually
right.
leaked this. And then he accused General Wedemeyer, who supposedly was his very good friend, of doing this, knowing full well that he himself had done it. And this is exactly what our government does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here we...
Well, Roosevelt came up with this, phony map of South America
right.
showing how the Nazis planned to conquer South America and divide it. And we now know that the origin of this was the British Secret Service. They most likely executed the map itself. We know that it wasn't of German origin, and we have every reason to believe that the British themselves manufactured this map and gave it to Roosevelt. And he gave a press conference, and he held this map up to the whole world and said, look, the Germans are threatening the Western Hemisphere, and this is what they plan to do. And they had South America all divided up into various divisions that were going to be ruled by the Nazis. Totally phony. Piece of egregious propaganda.
So like so much of what we're getting today is just propaganda.
And in the first Gulf War too, where we had the phony atrocity stories. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Well, you mean when the wicked Iraqi soldiers were going into the nurseries and the hospitals and taking the children out
and so forth.
Yeah, I think I'm right. And of course, the story when it finally came out came from the daughter of the Iraqi ambassador, I guess the Kuwaiti ambassador out of Washington, D.C. She had never been in Kuwait during this. She was simply telling this phony story to inflame the American people to justify our going to war.
Oh, yes, and it turns out some public relations firm was paid by the Bush administration to fabricate this stuff.
Right.
Really, really incredible. And also we were shown evidence of how the Iraqi armies were right on the border of Saudi Arabia, and then it later turned out that they were actually about 125 miles away from those borders. And the aerial reconnaissance photographs were doctored in order to show that.
But of course that was used to get the Saudis to let us put our troops on their soil, which it sort of inflamed this whole world Islamic movement.
Yeah, yes, and that was an incredible episode too, because we actually had to bribe them to let us in so we could allegedly defend them against Iraq. And I mean, these techniques to people who read history seem almost childishly transparent. They really do. You say, this is deja vu. This is where we came in. I've seen this all before.
That's like deja vu all over again.
Deja vu all over again. It's like, you know, the British atrocity stories about the Germans and Belgium during the First World War. And you say, this is a page from a very old playbook. And yet people fall for it all the time.
Well, I can remember Bill Clinton talking about the rape of the women in Kosovo. You know, and how that's why we had to be involved over there and to protect the women who are being raped. At the same time, of course, you know, he was being charged with having raped a woman here.
That was quite ironic, wasn't it?
It really was.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, of course, we're going to have to take a break here. And when we get back, of course, now we'll open up the lines for calls. If you're out there across America and you want to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And we certainly hope that you'll give us a call if you have a question. Certainly, David Wade has done an excellent, excellent job. His book, Infamy Revisited, Another Look at Pearl Harbor. And we recommend that to you. It's an excellent book, and of course it's especially apropos now, as we see almost like deja vu all over again. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do as we reach out across America with the truth about what's going on, trying to make people understand we're being manipulated, that there are agent provocateurs in our midst, that the CIA has people planted within the media, actually regulating and altering what we see, people planted within the publishing houses. And so a lot of good stories that really will tell you the truth, you just can't get published through regular channels. Or if you get them published, why, somebody destroys the plates or destroys the book. Happened to Monica Jensen Stevenson, 5,000 copies, or maybe it was 10,000 copies of her book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, printed up in Canada, and they just accidentally shredded them. Monica thinks it just happened by accident. I don't. I think that we've seen this story too many times through the years of how a really important book is not going to get out. Now, fortunately, the book we're talking about this evening, Infamy, is published by Hearthstone, and they certainly are a publishing house that's on our side. They don't, their books never get on the New York Times bestseller list, no matter how many copies are sold across America, but at least there's an opportunity to get the truth out. So if you'd like to know the suggested donation for the book, why it's Infamy Revisited, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about how you can become a member of the Radio Liberty family, give Mary a call there. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. And then, of course, we ask you to give a serious consideration to going to our website at www.radioliberty.com to tell others about our radio programs, to tell them about our website, where you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet and pull down all sorts of archive programs. But it's your job to help us get the truth out across America. I can only reach so many people, but you talking to others. And there are people out there who are looking for the truth, and we'll give you the truth as best we can, based upon our knowledge of history and excellent guests like we have this evening, who's really studied what happened at Pearl Harbor. And it's so important when you compare what happened then with what's happening today, as America is moving rapidly towards World War III. And if you think that this war is only going to involve the people in the Middle East, I think that you are sadly, sadly mistaken. I think there are going to be terrible repercussions here at home. I hope and pray that I'm wrong, but, we'll have to wait and see. Well, Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is David Wade. His book, Infamy Revisited, The Story of Pearl Harbor. And if you'd like to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. You don't have to be bashful or hold off. We've really got most of the story out. Now, of course, a story goes on, and the terrible things that happened that day. Why don't you talk a little bit about certainly General Marshall. Now, here General Marshall knows the attack is coming, and what does he do that morning?
Well, even his admirers find his behavior in the hours prior to Pearl Harbor rather difficult to explain. General Marshall liked to go out horseback riding Sunday mornings, and his intelligence officer, a man by the name of Colonel Rufus Bratton, was desperately trying to get a hold of him because the Japanese had transmitted the so-called 14-part message to their ambassadors in Washington, D.C., Caruso and Nomura. This message made it very clear that war was now going to break out between the United States and Japan, coinciding with 8 o'clock in the morning Hawaiian time. Well, Bratton found, after a lengthy search, General Marshall, after Marshall came back from his horseback ride. And Marshall, at first, didn't seem to be particularly interested in this decoded message, which absolutely astounded Bratton, because it was quite plain to him as an intelligence officer that this was something of the greatest magnitude. This meant that war between the United States and Japan was going to break out any minute, and we could expect a Japanese attack.
On Pearl Harbor.
On Pearl Harbor,
right.
Yeah, on Pearl Harbor. We'd known, as I said, for a long time that the war between the United States and Japan was imminent. We had known that for months, but we didn't know exactly where and exactly when. Well, we knew where and when now because of this message. We had every reason to believe it. And he suggested that, General Marshall, don't you think you ought to notify Admiral Kimmel, General Short? Marshall refused to use the transoceanic telephone to do so, although it was in perfect working order.
Now, this has been spontaneous communication, right?
Yeah, spontaneous communication, just like picking up the phone and me talking to you right now. He could have done that. No, because he was afraid that his wire had been tapped by the Japanese. Well, then he was going to send them a message by way of what was called WAR, the war circuit. The war circuit would have conveyed the message not as fast as a telephone, But I would have gotten there in a short period of time, and within a matter of minutes. But he claimed that there was something wrong with the circuit and it wasn't working right. So he finally resorted to using the landlines of RCA.
Western Union, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, from RCA to Western Union in Hawaii. RCA conveyed it by landline and then sent, received it by landline, and then it was sent by way of Western Union to Hawaii. And a Western Union courier, a little, matter of fact, he was Japanese, Japanese-American boy on a bicycle, was the one who finally delivered the message after the right when at the time when the Japanese attack was just coming to a close, and of course it was too late to do anything. And the mysterious thing about all of this is that the actual war lines we now know were perfectly operable. There was nothing wrong with them, and as a matter of fact, over the same line, a message was sent to General MacArthur in Manila in the Philippines, which he received in great dispatch within a matter of minutes.
Right.
There's no reason in the world why they couldn't have used the same line to notify Admiral Kimmel and General Short.
But, of course, they didn't, because it's very obvious that they did not want them to know. Had Admiral Kimmel known, he would have immediately put his battleships to sea. They wouldn't have been there to be destroyed.
Well, you know, I wish I had handy the actual transcript of General Marshall being cross-examined about this, because it's a masterpiece of incoherence. Just one of the hallmarks of double talk that you will ever encounter in your life is his sputtering and incoherent explanation as to why he decided to do this.
Well,
but he managed to get away with it. They didn't press him too hard. He was a man of enormous prestige, and you know, he was considered a great American patriot and hero and so forth. And they let him off the hook. He was asked about it, but the cross-examiner, I forgot who actually conducted the cross-examination, did not follow up too closely on it.
Well, unfortunately, there was a lot of treason. In fact, according to John Tolan in his book Infamy, General Marshall got all the major commanders together, you know, in the military and navy, and said, you know, the secret of what happened at Pearl Harbor will have to go to the grave with all of us.
Oh yes, yeah.
And you know, what was the secret? Well, they couldn't let the American people know the truth any more than they can let them know the truth about why we're really going to have war with Iraq, why we went to war with Afghanistan, what happened really
right
on the morning of September 11th. And, of course, this pattern of lying to the American people, plausible denial, you know, this is the thing. You always have to have a cover story, but the American people can't know the truth. And if we can't know the truth, then we cannot be free. And that, of course, what this is all about. And that's why your book is so important, because
yeah,
it's a reminder of what happened in the past, and the past is always prologue to the future.
Well, there are a lot of things about Pearl Harbor that remain very murky and unclear, and may always remain so. But there are a few things that stand out now with unmistakable clarity, and that is that the Japanese fleet did not maintain radio silence, that we intercepted those messages. In the case of the 12th U.S. Naval Station, those interceptions went to Commander Richard McCullough, not to be confused with Arthur McCullum. But what is interesting about Richard McCullough is that he, too, was a longtime personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's and had access to Harry Hopkins' private telephone number at the White House. And it's just inconceivable that through this route, if by no other, Roosevelt would have known that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming before it did. We also know that not only had we broken the Japanese Purple Code, which was the diplomatic code, but we had broken the Japanese naval and military codes, JN-25A and JN-25B, or at least JN-25B in part. It gets kind of complicated here, and I won't go into the cryptography, but the bottom line is that we not only were able to intercept messages that Japanese diplomats were sending among and between each other all over the world, we were also able to intercept the destination and location of Japanese ships all over the Pacific. This was before Pearl Harbor, and those interceptions Most of them were funneled through station cast in the Philippines, but they were not shared with Admiral Kimmel. Kimmel didn't see them, and of course neither did General Short. Matter of fact, although there was a magic machine that could decrypt the purple code on the island of Oahu, Kimmel didn't even know about this, and he wasn't even permitted to see the purple code decrypts either. He didn't know that they existed.
And, you know, Kirsty, the tragedy of this whole thing is that, they knew it was going to happen, but, of course, to this very day, this has been kept from the American people. Now, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, when people wanted to bring out the truth, they'd say, oh, no, we can't bring out the truth because we don't want the Japanese to know that we had broken their codes.
And there are still all sorts of decrypts that the government is still setting on.
In other words, they're classified in the name of national security.
Yes, are still classified. After all these years, over 60 years since Pearl Harbor has been bombed, the government is still keeping a lot of this stuff secret. Okay. They released a whole bunch of it. Jimmy Carter, when he was president, released some 300,000 Japanese decrypts that were intercepted before Pearl Harbor, but most of them are completely innocuous nature and do not directly bear at all on the attack at Pearl Harbor. And there is all kinds of stuff, as I said earlier, for instance, like those 67 cleansed monographs that just seem to have disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to them.
Well, I think it's so interesting. Then, of course, after the war, I think actually it was during the war when Thomas Dewey was running in 1944 against FDR, and I think it was General Marshall who went to Thomas Dewey and said, well, you could bring this out, but, I mean, aren't you a loyal American citizen?
Yeah, right.
And do you realize this could hurt the war effort?
Dewey was the Republican candidate for president when Roosevelt ran for his fourth term in 1944, and Dewey, I think he was in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the time, and he had gotten wind of the fact that we'd broken the Japanese code, the purple code, the diplomatic code, and he was going to use that in a campaign speech. And Marshall found out about this, and he sent a personal emissary to Dewey's hotel room and said, look, in the name of being a good patriot, you will not say that, because that will let the Japanese know that we have broken their code, and they're still using the purple code, which, as a matter of fact, happened to be true. But Dewey, as a patriot, America's at war, and he doesn't want to do anything that will aid the enemy, didn't mention it.
And then, of course, after the war, when it became obvious that this whole thing had been contrived, then they said, well, it was really a brilliant move on Roosevelt's part. Yes, it's a terrible thing about those boys who died at Pearl Harbor, but we had to get America into the war to stop the wicked Adolf Hitler, never, of course, mentioning that Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandfather, financed Adolf Hitler during the war, not just before. And, of course, anybody who studied this know that we financed Adolf Hitler both before and during the war. Our banks were involved with that, and as was Prescott Bush. But, of course, we can't let that out, because we have to then justify Pearl Harbor, that it was a terrible thing, but, of course, it got us into the war, and, of course, otherwise Adolf Hitler would have taken
the war. And as a matter of fact, that is the last line of defense, and there are a lot of people who will resort to that. They will say, yeah, it's true, Roosevelt lied to us. Yes, it's true, our commanders in Hawaii were left in the dark, and it was a great tragedy that 2,400 American servicemen had to die, but only America could save the world from Hitler, and this was the way to do it.
Well, in Robert Peer's excellent book, See No Evil, he was a senior CIA operative in northern Iraq in 1995. His book is really fascinating, and I recommend it to our listeners. There, of course, he tells about one of his friends, a reporter, who talked to one of the highest people in the CIA, who said, well, after the dust settles, after September 11th, the American people will realize that this was not a failure for the CIA, it was a triumph. Now, how could the death of 5,000 Americans be a triumph? Well, it would be if, of course, we were doing something for the better good. I mean, we have to get the war into the Middle East, of course, to put down those wicked Islamists. Of course, nobody ever wants to mention we created the Islamic movement and funded it and financed it and nurtured it. But now we have to, of course, put this down because it's a threat to America. And I'm sure there's some people who really look upon it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that, of course, is the geopolitical point of view. People who think big and are not restrained by traditional standards of morality when it comes to telling the truth and acting upon it, and who actually think that deception is a virtue.
And I think that there are radical Islamists out there who would just love to destroy this country. And the more we keep doing to infuriate them, the more irrational they're going to become, and maybe they will do some terrible, terrible things. But, of course, the most insignificant thing we could do would be to stop poking the stick in the eye of the rattlesnake, because when you poke a stick in the eye of a rattlesnake, he's going to strike back at you.
Well, as you know, as a matter of fact, I don't know whether you know it or not, but that is exactly the same metaphor that was used by former President Herbert Hoover. After Pearl Harbor was attacked, and someone asked him about it, he said, "Well, you keep sticking pins in a rattlesnake, and what do you think is going to happen?" Because former President Hoover was well aware that his successor had been for a long time trying to provoke Japan into attacking the United States, and indeed he succeeded.
Well, I think it's vitally important that the American people know the history of the Second World War. And what was it that George Santayana said? Those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it, right?
Yes.
And I think it's so vitally important that you understand what happened before, and then you can begin to almost anticipate what the next move will be. In fact, actually, when Saddam Hussein turned over his 12,000 pages of documents to the United Nations, initially the United Nations wasn't going to, give this to the United States until, they had a time to go through this. And apparently we put pressure on all the members of the Security Council so we could get our hands on these 12,000 pages so we could say it isn't true, because we know Saddam Hussein has these weapons, and that's why we're going to have to go to war with him.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, they put him in a trick bag. It was a catch-22 situation for Saddam Hussein. If he has weapons of mass destruction and admits it, then he is guilty and we're going to war with him. And if he doesn't have them, then that's because he's concealing them, and that makes him even worse, and we're going to war with him.
And, of course, as I was saying to a friend of mine today, if the world does not want us to go to war with him, how would we possibly be able to do that? Well, we could shoot down one of our planes, blame it on Saddam Hussein, and that would be an excellent means of getting to war. Even though our planes are flying over and bombing his country and have been for many years. Now, I have no sympathy for Saddam Hussein. He's a wicked and evil man. But we put him in power, we kept him in power, and we've maintained him in power. And as Robert Byrd says in his book, See No Evil, we knew in 1995 that he was smuggling oil out through Turkey, and of course using that to strengthen his military and to keep his people enslaved, and we did absolutely nothing about it. We could have stopped it at any time by simply telling the Turks to stop letting him smuggle the oil through their country. And we didn't do it. In other words, we were actually, with all this talk, about how wicked Saddam Hussein was in 1995, why we were helping to allow him to be subsidized by the illegal sale of oil, all the time posturing and telling the American people we were standing against this wicked, wicked tyrant. So it's all, everything is smoke and mirrors and impressions. It's about time the American people begin to think and understand we're being manipulated.
Well, if you want to go to war against evil regimes, then there is no limit of candidates for that, and the logic of that is that America will always be at war with somebody. It really is a policy of perpetual war. I'm very fond of a quotation. I believe it was President John Quincy Adams that says America should not go abroad looking for dragons to slay, because we are well-wishers to liberty everywhere, but custodians only of our own.
And, of course, my fear is that there will be other countries in the Middle East. It may well be that one of the next countries on the list will be North Korea. After all, they apparently have gone ahead and built this nuclear bomb. But if you can tell me that we had no idea what they were doing, then we have been funneling tremendous amounts of free oil into North Korea to keep their economy going. And, of course, we're building this special type of nuclear plant there that doesn't breed or produce plutonium. We've been really giving them countless hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fuel all these years, and we had no idea they were building a bomb.
Yes.
Is our intelligence really that inadequate, or is it that we've known all along exactly what we were going, and we were actually funding the North Koreans so they would have the funds to build their bombs?
Yeah, well, our indignation over tyrannical regimes is highly selective, isn't it?
Right, and of course you never know what's real and what is being put out simply for the benefit of the suckers here in America. And as somebody once said, never underestimate how naive the American people can be.
H.L. Mencken, yeah, you'll never go broke betting on the underestimating the intellect of the American voter, I think, was the quotation.
But they're good people, and I love the Americans, and there's no better people in the whole world. Well, what we have to do, of course, is get them informed and let them understand, because they're only really naive because they've been lied to, and because they think we have a free press, not understanding the freedom of the press means if you own the press, you have the ability to lie anytime you want to and to distort what the American people read. And once you understand that, then everything begins to make sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we've got about 3 or 4 more minutes here before we have to let you go. What are some of the really important things that you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight? What are the major points that your book is going to tell them?
Well, my book, of course, is about Pearl Harbor, but it's more than just Pearl Harbor. It is about the entire conduct of the Second World War by the Roosevelt administration. And it also involves some speculation about alternative scenarios, what might have happened had we stayed out of the war. It is about our collaboration with the Soviet Union and the tragic results of that. There were those who felt that if we had stayed out of the war, Germany and the Soviet Union would have fought each other to mutual exhaustion. There was also a good chance that the German government under Hitler would have been overthrown, because there were people we know that were plotting against Germany. However, one of the great blunders of the Roosevelt administration was to insist upon a policy of unconditional surrender, which meant that the Germans felt they had to fight to the last man for the sake of their country. Otherwise, it might have been possible for the Allies to have struck a separate peace with Germany that would have saved Europe from Soviet domination and overthrown Hitler's tyranny.
In fact, I think for our listeners, they have to understand that the German generals had offered to surrender just so long as, Russia would not be allowed to occupy Germany. This was the thing they feared. And we wouldn't negotiate with them. They were willing to throw in the towel, and time and time and time again they tried to negotiate a surrender, and we wouldn't let them any more than we'd let the Japanese surrender. They tried for 6 months before the end of the war to surrender, and it was the invasion.
Once again, it was Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender that applied to the Japanese too, and it was that imposed upon us the terrible dilemma we've got. Either we've got to invade the Japanese homelands, and who knows what we might sustain. It was estimated maybe 1 million casualties, or we drop atomic bombs on Japan in order to force them to accept unconditional surrender.
But, of course, what the American people never knew was the Japanese had tried to surrender, and their only specification was that Hirohito not be tried as a war criminal.
Yes, and we never made that clear. You read the Potsdam Declaration that was issued after Truman became president, and it demands unconditional surrender, and specifically omits any reference to the Japanese being able to retain their emperor. And the great irony of it is that we ended up making that concession anyway. We let them keep their emperor. If we had made that clear in the first place, we might have been able to end the war without having to either face an invasion of the Japanese homelands or the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And we wouldn't have had to invade Okinawa or Iwo Jima.
We may have been able to end the war months before it actually ended if we had made that clear. But we're going to make a few concessions to you, and we'll let you keep your emperor.
And anybody would like to see the article out of the Chicago Tribune, we have that signed on. The article was on the very day of the signing of the peace treaty on the Missouri by the Japanese, and it pointed out they'd been trying to surrender for 6 months. They'd tried five times, and we wouldn't let them surrender. What does that suggest? Maybe nothing is that as appears to be today.
I think that is a good place to draw a halt.
All right,
and in
fine.
The famous words of General Douglas MacArthur, these proceedings are closed.
I want to thank you so very much, David. It's been a fascinating 2 hours.
Yes,
I hope we can get you onto some of our other programs. As you know, we do 5 hours a day, and I think your story is so vitally important.
Well, I would appreciate that.
God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
God bless you.
Bye-bye. And our guest this evening has been David Wade, and of course, we're talking about his book, Infamy Revisited, the story of Pearl Harbor. And so we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders. We ask you to pray for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival in America. Because if America doesn't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on America forever. And you're going to see the wrath of God in here in terrible, terrible form, as the children of Israel saw when they turned their back on God. And every time they did, God brought judgment upon their nation. And so please, of course, remember as well to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back again with you tomorrow evening at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you.
More orders?
Here's $20 for the newsletter. I said, you know, I just have to. He said, oh, he wanted to help.